Hello everyone, welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we are examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated. They're being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I'm your host, I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD, former chief economist, and head of business innovation strategy at GE. Prior to that, I worked in policy and in finance, and my expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today is Dr. Tiffany Vora. Tiffany is a board member and vice president for innovation partnerships at Explore Mars, a nonprofit advancing sustainable and inclusive exploration of Mars and beyond by the 2030s. In these roles, Tiffany focuses on how technological innovation in key areas such as biotechnology, AI, quantum computing, robotics, and more can benefit life in space as well as life on Earth. Regulation, development of the space economy and workforce, international cooperation, peace, and far horizon possibilities for each of these fall within her purview. Tiffany also serves as faculty and Singularity Fellow in Biotechnology at Singularity University and as faculty at EY Tech University. She previously worked in the pharmaceutical industry, was a visiting assistant professor at the American University in Cairo, an instructor in bioengineering at Stanford University. She founded two companies focused on science and tech communication and was the faculty director of Singularity University's International Community of Experts and Practitioners. A molecular biologist by training, Tiffany serves as a subject matter expert in biotechnology and innovation and as an advisor to various international organizations and venture capital firms focused on space, medicine, longevity, and agriculture. She leads educational experiences for private organizations around the world and for the Center for Homeland Defense and Security at the Naval Postgraduate School. Tiffany holds undergraduate degrees in biology and chemistry from New York University and, even more importantly, a PhD in molecular biology from Princeton University, so we share the alma mater. Tiffany, Dr. Vora, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to the podcast.
I am absolutely delighted to be part of this conversation today.
Anything else you want to share with the audience about your current interest, anything that I haven't covered in the bio?
I think a thing that we should always come back to when we talk about tech in the future is who we are as people. So yes, I'm a biologist. I am someone who's deeply interested in tech and how it affects our lives. I'm also a mother. I'm a daughter. I'm a sister. I'm a neighbor. I'm all of these things. And I bet your audience also thinks of themselves as that as well. So when we picture ourselves in the future, I love for us to picture ourselves kind of in all our identities that we carry along with us.
I couldn't agree more. This is an very important point and an excellent way to shape and frame our conversation. So, Tiffany, you're an expert in biomimicry. In fact, one of your favorite phrases is biology is technology. Can you explain to our audience what you mean by it, and what biomimicry actually is?
So when I say biology is technology, I'm pointing to the fact that thanks to a variety of technologies and breakthroughs in the last 50 years, particularly in the last 20 years, we are at a point where with great power and precision, although also with some surprises still, we're able to access and manipulate the source code of life. So just in case folks don't spend all day, every day thinking about biology like I do, just as a quick refresher from high school bio, all life on Earth is related, all life on Earth is made of cells, and all life on Earth runs on essentially the same operating system, which is DNA, right? DNA is a chemical molecule. It's made up of four building blocks that for short we call ACTNG. So if you think of computers as storing information as zeros and ones, life on Earth stores information as ACTNG. Now, of course, there's more to it than that, which keeps biology endlessly interesting and fascinating and surprising and frustrating and all of these things that make being a biologist so wonderful. But we are at this point now where life and technology, we shouldn't be thinking of those as separate things anymore. We can access the source code of life. We can reprogram it. We can move programming modules around. And on top of that, the boundaries between the silicon and the biological world are all starting to drop. So it's becoming this more integrated thing where life isn't separate from our various industrial verticals. It's not separate from how we think about building our cities or living our lives. And I would say from a personal standpoint, because of that, I think it's both exciting, but also really important that people understand what becomes possible using these biotechnologies and how it could impact their lives, hopefully for the better. But there are both positive possible futures as well as less preferred futures. And we're at this amazing moment where the decisions that we make today about how we use biology as a technology will bias us either toward or away from these preferred futures.
So this is a fascinating introduction. You already brought up a number of points that I think we'll have to delve in much more deeply. So first of all, the biomimicry, I was forced to study Latin and Greek in high school back in Italy, so I think I understand what it means, but how do you define it?
Right. So biomimicry is this field that's been around for several decades now. There was a wonderful seminal book that was written in the 90s called Biomimicry, and I recently reread it over the summer and couldn't recommend it more. But basically what biomimicry means is a discipline, a design discipline of looking to the natural world for inspiration. And folks have been doing this for many years. It's not new. I even read about Leonardo da Vinci looking into the natural world for inspiration for some of his engineering designs. So it's not a new idea. Where I like to take this is another direction. Biomimicry is part of it, but also thinking about bioinspiration. So thinking about life on Earth, let's say we've had life on Earth for, let's call it 4 billion years. That means for 4 billion years, natural processes have been running experiments here on Earth. And where we see our landed today, we can see the outcomes of many of those experiments. And that's at everything from the atomic to the molecular, to the cellular, to the tissue, to the organs, to organismal, to ecosystems levels. Biology operates across all of these levels of hierarchy. And so when we are able to embrace this mindset of saying humans are pretty good at coming up with solutions or experiments, nature is really good at experimenting. Nature has had a lot longer than we've had in order to run these experiments. And I would say nature is much more vicious about deciding what works and what doesn't work in a way that humans, we still bring our emotions to our experiments and our innovations, no matter how much we try not to bias ourselves. The natural world doesn't carry that emotional baggage. So one thing that I love to look at is, what are the things, the lessons that we can extract from what the natural world seems to be telling us about storing information, transmitting information, how much repetition there should be? We talk a lot about mutation as if it's a bad thing, but in the natural world, variation is a feature. It's not a bug. It only works if mistakes, and I'm making air quotes, if mistakes happen. And so we have these human systems that have built up over the last couple of hundred years, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, saying, make your widget exactly the same every single time. But biology has shown us over 4 billion years, that is a fragile system. So if we want to move into a world, and I hope it's a world that we are moving into, that is resilient, that is anti-fragile, that has the capacity to change, to withstand large, I think the natural world is a wonderful place to look like that, to look for those things. So biomimicry and bioinspiration are both ways we can do that. The other reason I like to use the term bioinspiration as an expansion of this idea is biomimicry is a wonderful way of looking outside ourselves and saying, here's how we can look for solutions, inspirations, innovations to the natural world. But I also believe as a biologist that we can use the way we learn about the world around us to turn that gaze inward and also think about ourselves as leaders, as individuals, as innovators, as problem solvers, as folks who in the next 50 years are probably going to face some of the toughest challenges that our species has ever faced in our long evolutionary history. It's only going to get more challenging from here, in my opinion, for the next 50 years. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion as well, we should be using every single tool at our disposal. And fortunately, the natural world is full of those.
You've made a very important point, Tiffany, which is essentially with the digital revolution, when we look at software and digital technology, we always stress the importance of experimenting at scale. And what you're saying is that nature has been problem solving at scale for a long time, at enormous scale, and with a very well-defined and very powerful incentive structure and reward system. So it's worth taking seriously the solutions it has arrived at. You also mentioned that the field of or the idea of biomimicry and bioinspiration is not new. It's been around for a while. But it feels from your enthusiasm like we're now entering a new phase, right? The idea of bioinspiration can be especially important and especially powerful now. Why is it? I understand that I tend to agree that we probably face tougher challenges now than we have in the past. But why? Why is bioinspiration especially important today?
I think the reason that bioinspiration is so important today is because of the power of the tools and the processes that we have in order to take tools of investigation and turn them into tools of engineering. So let me unpack that a little bit. So we used to use, and for many years have used, DNA sequencing in order to understand how life organizes information at the molecular level. So when I say DNA sequencing, I'm talking about a series of technologies that enable you to read off the ACTG letter, like strand of information, kind of one at a time. Same way you would, like if you looked at binary, it's a code of zeros and ones. So if you understand those ACTs and Gs, that tells you a lot about how life organizes itself, how it runs itself, how it reproduces itself. But now where we are, in addition to being able to read the programming language of life, now we can actually write the programming language of life. So that started, I would say, probably back in the 1970s with genetic engineering technology, which was a huge breakthrough. It's why, this is a simple example, it's why folks who are diabetic get insulin from bacteria and not from grinding up human corpses, right? Or animal corpses. Like, this is an amazing revolution that started happening in the 70s. And again, like we can unpack that a bit. But now where we are is not just moving snippets of code from one organism to another. Now we're able to write DNA code from scratch. That's called synthetic biology. I'm sure we'll talk more about that now. But even deeper than that, today where we stand at this AI revolution, now thanks to the rise of computers and how important computing has become in biology, now we're able to do things at scale in ways we never were able to do before. When I was a graduate student at Princeton, my thesis project, which now seems kind of quaint, even though it wasn't that long ago, but at the time, I invented a technology that when I got it to work, suddenly I was sitting on 19 million data points. And I was like, oh my God, what do I do with all this data? I was not prepared for that. And so I had to teach myself statistics. I had to teach myself computer programming, and I had to teach myself all of these things. Now, fortunately, 20 whatever years later, I think folks going into biology expect to need advanced math. They expect to need to be able to program in ways that we were just sort of discovering on the fly back then. But so we've got biological tools, we've got computational tools. Now we've got more advanced robotics and optics than we've never had before. And on top of that, the AI revolution is also coming to biology. So I say we're at this inflection point where Not only are we better able to look at what nature has already tried out here on Earth than we ever have been before, now we're empowered to start exploring parameter spaces that, to our knowledge, nature has not explored on this planet. Either because it doesn't work, which we'll find out, or because, you know, historically speaking, life started in a particular parameter space, and then from there, it moved to other parameter spaces that were energy minima, blah, blah, blah. It's never, this is the most boring it's ever going to be. And that is either terrifying or inspiring or both. For me, it's a yes. And that's why I'm so enthusiastic about this. I mean, when I look now at what like the Stanford students down the road from me are doing in the laboratory every day, and I compare that to what I did, the precision, the speed, the depth, and I would say the creativity that they're able to deploy looks nothing like what I was doing even just a couple of decades ago.
So give us a sense, Tiffany, of what we can look at. I tend to agree with you. I think it's both inspiring and terrifying. Without, it's too early in the podcast to terrify our audience. So maybe veering more to the inspiring side. Give us a sense of what it is that we've started doing now with these new, more powerful tools that wasn't possible before.
A beautiful example is the approval in the US and the UK about a year ago of the first gene editing based medical therapeutics. So this is a cure for sickle cell disease. So sickle cell disease is a disease we all learn about in biology class because it's due to a single mutation at the DNA level that changes one amino acid in this giant protein into a different amino acid. And because of that one change in one place on the DNA, it causes the red blood cells in this person's body to change from being kind of like a nice plump round shape to being the sickle shape. And then what happens is those red blood cells, they build up in people's capillaries. They cause all kinds of health problems, excruciating pain. It's a terrible disease to have to live with. And it's actually quite common because, as it turns out, sickle-celled red blood cells, folks who have that genotype end up less susceptible to malaria. So you would think such a terrible disease would get bred out of the population, but in fact, it was protective against malaria. So in Africa, many African populations have a relatively high rate of sickle cell anemia. So it's out there. And I'm American. I live in the United States. A lot of African Americans are also at risk for this condition because of how the inheritance happened. So that is what we think of as low-hanging fruit when we think about using these biotechnological tools to cure a disease, because it's one gene, one disease. It's a straight shot. Most human disease, the vast majority of human disease, is a complex interplay between lots and lots of stuff on the DNA and lots of parameters in your environment. Sickle cell anemia is not that. So in this case, what the researchers did was very clever. So they used these gene editing technologies. CRISPR is the most famous one that most people have probably heard of, but there's other ones like base editing and some other ones that enable you to go in and essentially precisely and permanently change the DNA code. You might remember the two co-founders of this, which, by the way, is not a human invention. Bacteria have been using it for millions of years as part of their bacterial immune system. So, but several researchers had they had the inspiration to say, wait a second, this could actually be used as a tool. It's not just the bacterial immune system. They won the Nobel Prize. It was very exciting for everyone. So this tool was used in order to do a very clever way of essentially curing sickle cell in human patients. And it has to do with turning on the copy of the gene that, when you're a fetus, is a different gene that makes this particular protein. It works fine in the fetus. But then when you're born, that copy of the gene gets shut off. And the broken copy, if you have sickle cell anemia, gets turned on. So what these folks figured out how to do was to turn the fetal version back on. So you're not erasing anything. You're not cutting anything out. What they did was reactivate a copy that was already there, already present in the genome. Super clever, very clever. And it's not trivial to do this. You have to wipe out bone marrow and do a whole bunch of complicated things. But I would invite the audience, anytime you're feeling kind of bad about humanity, go watch the videos of the patients who have been cured using this technique and listen to how it changed their lives. I mean, it's amazing, absolutely amazing. And this is just the first one in the pipeline, the first one to get approved by multiple regulatory agencies. So imagine a future in which not all, but many human genetic diseases can be cured, not treated, cured, right? Lots of questions. How do you price this? How do you make sure you get access to it, right? Lots of really important questions. But this first time out of the gate doing it, this is a big deal. And it makes me feel really excited about the types of things that can be coming down the line in the next decades once we have our clinical trial data that these things are safe and effective.
It is truly inspiring. It actually triggers a very perhaps ignorant, uninformed question, which is the following. So clearly, as you've illustrated, we can use synthetic biology and our ability to modify or rewrite DNA to cure diseases which are caused by flaws or malfunctioning mutations in the DNA. Can we also use it to cure diseases that are not DNA dependent? Can we or will we be able to rewrite or modify the DNA so that it makes us better able to fight off diseases that are caused by the environment or by things other than our own DNA?
So the short answer is not yet. In fact, before looking at that trajectory, I would actually look first to like the mRNA technology and the vaccine technology as a way to do that. Because what those are, you can think of that as being like a temporary upgrade to your DNA. You're not actually changing the source code. You're changing the compiled code, if that analogy helps, right? So it's literally like a patch, like a security patch you would download to your laptop. So there are already places where, for example, there's some heart disease treatments that are mRNA-based heart disease treatments that are in clinical trials right now that would help you make more of something that would delay or prevent heart disease. That's an interesting model to me because there the synthetic piece isn't rewriting DNA, but it's using your body as the hardware that boots up some sort of biological software and then executes that. So that's why the mRNA vaccine revolution was such a big deal and why that COVID bump was very important. As a reminder, COVID vaccines, the mRNA vaccines were not invented during COVID. Folks have been working on them for decades, trying to use them for cancer vaccines. And we're going to see a lot of action in that space in the coming years. But the idea, though, is if you had an mRNA vaccine during COVID, your body is the hardware that boots up this short little piece of instruction that says to your body, build just one part of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Don't build the whole virus. That's why those vaccines cannot give you COVID, because the virus just isn't there. But your body makes just enough of one piece for your immune system to learn to recognize it. So the next time that thing shows up in the form of the whole virus, which you got from someone out in the world, your immune system is ready to fight it. So that mentality of biology as hardware, biology as technology, our body is the hardware, that is a mental model that I think will be useful for what you said. Can we use this to cure, treat, prevent, delay other types of diseases? I would look to that model first before actually thinking about permanently changing the human genome. Now, can we permanently change the human genome? Maybe. You might remember in late 2018, there was the scandal of the CRISPR babies, the two baby girls. And actually, there's probably at least one more child that no one's talking about. These baby girls that were born in China who had ostensibly been gene edited via CRISPR as embryos during IVF. And that's a whole long, complicated story. It's never been validated independently scientifically the way that we expect to see happen in the scientific process, and lots of ethical questions and things like that. But that was kind of like the first go at, can we reprogram somebody from birth to be less susceptible? In this case, the researcher argued that he was putting in a mutation in the CCR5 gene, which makes a molecular door that HIV uses to get into the cell. And there are already people on Earth who have this mutation who are resistant to HIV infection because the virus can't get into the cells because of this mutation. So this researcher said, well, if I just move that mutation into these embryos, then they are, or in, well, into the embryo system, then if I have HIV positive people trying to undergo IVF, I can reduce the chances that the embryo will contract IVF during, will contract HIV during IVF. Now, there's a lot of arguments against that reasoning. Already, HIV transfer during IVF is extremely low, but that was at least what he said was his motivation for wanting to do this first experiment. And then the whole thing blew up, and who knows what the repercussions of this are going to be. So it doesn't necessarily seem to be technically impossible. The question is, should we do it? And who gets to decide and under what circumstances? And is that an opt-in system or an opt-out system? What does that look like? That's when things start to become really complicated. I remember at the end of 2018, MIT Tech Review published their yearly like biggest tech fails list that they always have in December. And that year, one of their biggest tech fails was gene-edited babies. And I remember reading that and thinking, they are talking about children. They are talking about baby girls who are growing up in a world where people have gone on record saying they're not human and they shouldn't exist. And as a reminder, that's what folks said about IVF babies 30 years ago, right? Could you imagine looking into an IVF child's face today and telling them they're not human and they shouldn't exist? So when I think about these big questions about can we and should we manipulate human DNA permanently, maybe from birth or even before, in order to make it less likely we have this disease, I absolutely have concerns. But I can also picture a future in which my son looks me in the face 50 years from now and says, you were holding a tool that could have prevented human suffering and you were afraid to use it. And I can picture myself having to answer that question too. I don't know how we get from there to here, right? There's many possible paths, but that's the future that I think about the most, where we're holding the tools and we're afraid to use them. What does that do to our legacy and our sense of responsibility?
It's a profound reflection on the responsibility we have, but also, you know, the first step is exactly to stare in the face the moral dilemmas that these technologies are raising. And as you pointed out with the IVF parallel, also reminding ourselves that it's not the first time that we face or we feel like we're facing similar ethical dilemmas. Before we get deeper into the issue of, you know, what can scare us about this future, I know you've recently spearheaded a research effort to look at synthetic biology in space, which is something that our NASA partners are especially interested in, obviously. So what can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. So Explore Mars sponsored a working group of experts in synthetic biology, folks from NASA Ames, from the University of Florida, and from the Crick Institute. And we talked to a wider group of experts as well. And so what we wanted to explore was, how can we bring synthetic biology as an enabling technology in order to solve for a lot of the problems, the fundamental challenges of long-term spaceflight, or let's look at Mars in particular, right? You're not going to get to go probably for less than, say, two and a half years. It's a long trip, right? And so you also have pretty severe up-mass constraints. So how could we be using biological systems to solve for some of those up-mass constraints and the fact that the stuff that you take with you, whether it's food, whether it's medicine, these types of things, degrade over time? Wouldn't it be better if you could make it instead of take it? And so we looked at synthetic biology as an interesting enabling paradigm here because it has some interesting affordances. Life is extremely information dense. So in terms of, for example, Lynn Rothschild's astropharmacy idea that rather than trying to take every medication that you need with you, what if you took a library of yeast or some other organism that you could wake up on demand and then could make the biological thing when you actually need it, right? That could be, you could make it more personalized. It would be on demand, small batch manufacturing, like these types of things. And another interesting affordance here is that so many of our systems here on Earth are petrochemical based, right? There's no petrochemicals on Mars. So if you want plastics, for example, you have to either bring them with you, or you can look to bioplastics and you can make them there as part of potentially some sort of circular ecosystem so that all of your waste gets fed back into a, as a biological feedstock into a synthetic biology cycle that then would output something else. Again, not a new idea. The lens that we looked at it was to say, okay, we've also got the Biden administration's executive order looking to spur the American bioeconomy. And we also know that there are many governments and other organizations like the EU around the world that have published various bioeconomy strategies for their nation or their group of nations. And so kind of now is the time when folks are thinking about turbocharging their bioeconomy for peace and prosperity and wellness and sustainability here on Earth. So we said, well, what would we need to do in order to take that model, deliver benefits to Earth right now, and plan, engineer benefits for Mars or space stations or whatever it is in the future? And so we identified a couple of breakthroughs that we think will help in advance both sets of things. So for example, more research on genetic chassis organisms. If you think of a chassis of a car and you have a basic chassis and then you can add different kinds of wheels on it, depending on whether you're building a race car or you're building a Jeep, whatever it is, you can actually do that with biological organisms as well. You can take the DNA that the organism comes with and then you can add stuff on to get the bacterium to make the thing that you actually want, right? That's synthetic biology and genetic engineering. Now, when we look at Mars, for example, we know we've got more salt, more radiation, less light, a bunch of other constraints that are different on Earth, different on Mars than on Earth. And so for many years, folks have been going and looking at extremophiles here on Earth, bacteria that have already evolved in nuclear reactor waste or in very salty lands or in very cold places, figure out the biology of that and either make those organisms genetically tractable so we can add things on, or take the pieces that nature has already invented and move them into organisms that we can work with better. But here we're back to that bio-inspiration theme, right? I don't have to invent biological resistance to radiation. Biology already did that, right? I just have to go look for it and figure out how to turn that from a biology problem into an engineering problem. That is not trivial, but it's at least biology then has gotten us part of the way there instead of us having to come up with this from scratch. So genetic chassis organisms, we think, really need investment today to get them ready for a time when, probably not in the next 10 years, but maybe 20 or 30 years from now, when there's a more sustained human presence, this would be more useful. We talked about the need for flight-tested hardware that enables small batch reproducible biological manufacturing. That is something that we think could be really useful, not just for space, but also for low resource or challenging environments here on Earth, remote communities, conflict zones, things like that. So again, how can we deliver that value here on Earth? And we were also really interested in shelf-stable reagents. If you don't have to refrigerate things when you are in space, again, that helps with your mass and your power and your fragility and all of these things. And oh, by the way, wouldn't it be great if we didn't need frozen reagents again for these low resource or challenging settings on Earth to enable people to have protein security or biological medicine security? If you don't have a freezer, you can't do those things, right? Wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to worry about that? And again, remember, biology doesn't store stuff frozen. So there's something there. We just have to unearth it. So that was kind of the look we were taking at it. What are the breakthroughs that can turbocharge the future of synthetic biology in space while delivering value, jobs, sustainability here on Earth?
extremely powerful, especially this solving both current and future problems at the same time. Tiffany, I want to bring you back to something you mentioned earlier, which is, you mentioned at the beginning, the convergence of biology-based and silicon-based technologies being one of the accelerants of today's revolution in bio-inspiration. Tell us a bit more of how the two are coming together.
Well, for example, we've already seen a couple of examples of this. If you know anyone who has an insulin pump, they might refer to themselves as a cyborg, right? They've got an implantable device that they can control from their phone. It runs on an algorithm that looks at what's going on in their body and then responds in real time using an actuated device, right? So again, this isn't the first time these things are happening. But what I'm seeing now that I think is really exciting is folks looking at ways to use technology not to replace humans, but rather to extend us our strength, our senses, our processing capacity, whatever it is, in order to essentially give humans superpowers by bringing together biology and technology. We've seen some beautiful results in the last few years about folks using this to be able to paralyzed people, for example, being able to type or being able to drink out of a cup from using a robot that they were able to control with a brain computer interface to bring the cup to their mouth. Those are really beautiful therapeutic uses of this. Imagine a future in which we can do more than that, right? Where it's not just therapy, but it could be enhancement. And that, again, can send you down some sort of Black Mirror rabbit hole. Or you can think, well, let's entertain, what if the longevity revolution actually happens and folks end up living much longer, healthier lives? Wouldn't it be great to use technology to help folks in these longer periods of their lives? Maybe even without the longevity revolution, today we have a lot of very frail elders. Wouldn't it be wonderful for them to be able to have physical support for their bodies, to minimize falls, to make the, keep them independent longer, to help them really bring the value to their lives that they say is important? That's what technology should be about. And so much of what we think of as ourselves, our sense of identity, is wrapped up in our bodies, right? So there are some people who are really excited about wearables and implantables and are the early adopters, the pioneers in that field. My fantasy is a day where it is completely normal for anyone at any point of their life to be using some combination of robot and AI and biology in order to be living their lives the way they want them to be lived, whether it's independently, whether it's bringing in more connection, whatever those things are. There's so much innovation going on in this space. I think it's so exciting. I mean, let me ask you, Marco, when you think about your life 40 years from now, what do you want it to look like? Like, what's not the details, but the feeling? What would a good life be for you?
The feeling would definitely be a feeling of being able to experience as much as possible of life around me. So it would be a life where I am as healthy as possible and where I'm able to enjoy everything, every aspect of the nature around me, the food I eat, what I drink. So the enjoyment of life, I think, would be the defining characteristic.
I love that idea of enjoyment of life. This is another great place where I'm excited about synthetic biology is in the food ecosystem. When we think about all of the flavors and the textures and these new things that become possible when we can break our reliance on industrial food production. Just as a couple of examples, a colleague of mine in Finland went and found these beautiful Arctic berries that are, you usually forage them. So you go up in the forest and you pick them. They're supposed to be delicious. I've never actually tried them before. And of course, they're under threat from climate change, from a warming climate. So several years ago, he figured out how to grow the cells from those berries in a bioreactor, so cellular agriculture, but with this very beautiful, delicate berry, and turn it into a jelly so that people could try it. A couple of you, I think it was just last year, remember there was that news article about the folks who had made a mammoth meatball? I mean, that was like a PR stunt. But imagine a future in which we no longer rely for 90% of our food calories from 15 species, 1-5. 90% of our food calories come from 15 species. That is an incredibly fragile system, right? It's also, to your point about enjoyment, like how many times can you eat chicken before chicken is boring? Well, if you can also eat mammoth and lion and all of these other kind of crazy things that we can't ethically or economically farm, that opens up a whole series of experiences that you could potentially have that I think would bring a great deal of delight to life. I'm a foodie, so I'm like 100% in. Hand Tiffany the mammoth meatball, I will 100% eat it because it's a new thing. It's a new thing for me to try. And it's not, I agree with you that a lot of this is about health, but we tend to package health as like a form of suffering, right? Like, oh, I have to exercise every day. Oh, I can only have one glass of wine, right? Whatever it is. There's another option out there where this pursuit of health is itself the pursuit of a good life. And in my fantasy, that's where technology takes us.
It's a much better way of looking at it. You also mentioned the potential for this technology to give us superpowers. And on that line, the thing that comes to mind, the thinking exactly of biology and looking at life for inspiration is, are there animal species perceive the world in completely different ways from us, right? You have birds who can perceive the magnetic field of the earth, animals who see different spectrum of light. You have bats which rely on the radar system. So is there, do you think this is also part of the future, potentially experimenting to see if we can, under some circumstances, avail ourselves of augmented sensory perceptions?
I think so. And there have been some interesting first steps in that direction. I'm trying to remember the details, but I remember a wonderful story about a haptic vest that was able to essentially transmit spatial information to blind people about like where obstacles were. And so when you learn to interact with the vest, they act kind of like eyes, right? Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting thing. Or what if echolocation was something that you could bring to the seeing impaired, right? That would help reduce the barriers to them operating in a world that has been constructed for people who can see, right? And again, if you want to go back to this idea of what would might the far future look like, there are folks like Chris Mason who argue that genetically engineering or otherwise enhancing humans for better suitability for living off Earth, it's not just possible. It's a moral imperative to do that. Why would you send people to a place that they haven't evolved for, knowing how it's going to impact their bodies, right? You might argue, and some people do, if we have the capacity to change that, we should be doing that. So George Church from Harvard, for example, has a list of these genes that are his like space genes, which are mutations that already exist in populations here on Earth. But you could imagine if you deliberately put those into humans to make them better astronauts, denser bones, better memories, needing less sleep, being able to operate with less oxygen, being a bit more radiation resistant. All of those as a package could make a better human astronaut or a better human inhabitant of Mars, which means we're back to Gattaca. Do you remember that movie, Gattaca? Yeah, it's still, I think, one of the best sci-fi explorations of this interplay between free will and genetic determinism. And what does that actually mean? So yeah, go out and watch that one streaming. It's a really good reminder. We're coming closer to that. We're not there yet, but there are definitely futures in which I see a combination of taking the biological ways of changing, either through DNA upgrades, RNA upgrades, whatever that is, and then blending that with a series of wearables and implantables and other types of robotics, which will be algorithm powered to further enhance our senses, our behaviors, our mobility, all of these things, and hopefully our connectivity, right? Our ability to really connect with other human beings. That's the piece that we're not going to lose to robots or algorithms anytime soon. And so I would love to see us leaning into those technologies that make us better people and have better relationships.
No, absolutely. And this actually brings us back to something else you said right at the beginning, which is your concept of people-centered technology and the idea that we as humans should be at the center of all this, together with another comment you made, which was how we should be looking at the natural world and then reflect it back onto ourselves and reflect on how we can be better leaders, better scientists. Talk a little bit more about this. How do we take this bio-inspiration approach and turn it into something that can make us better, not just by giving us superpowers or different ways of curing diseases, but also by changing the way that we look at ourselves and approach our being human?
I think some of this, the great lessons for me come from the scientific mindset that we have in looking at the natural world. And it's interesting, in recent years, I've been building a meditation practice for myself and looking at some of these, for example, Buddhist or Zen, like other ways of looking at the world. And it's interesting to me where there's overlap. And when I see overlap, my spidey sense starts tingling and I'm like, wait a second, there's something there. So one of the things that we're supposed to have all the time as scientists is intellectual humility. I was taught in the Karl Popper school of scientific thinking, which is that we don't prove our ideas. We try to disprove our ideas, right? And the classic example was, if you wanted to prove the statement that all swans are white, you would have to look at every single swan in the world to make sure every single one of them was white. But to disprove the idea that all swans are white, all you need is one black swan, right? So having the intellectual humility to walk into any room, any problem, and to say, the idea that I'm holding in my head, I'm probably wrong about, and it is my job to disprove it. That I don't know that people who are not scientists really understand that's what we're trying to do. When I hear about it in like the Buddhist and the meditation communities, I hear about them talking about holding our ideas lightly, holding our identity lightly, right? And to say, I think this now, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, right? Delusion masquerades as truth. And I feel that a lot in science. And along the same lines with that intellectual humility, I was taught that the only failed experiment is an experiment that tells you nothing. And so it surprises me when I hear people in tech, for example, say, oh, the experiment was a failure, so let's do something different. I'm like, wait, did you actually think about what your data are showing you? That's not a failure, right? I think as a biologist, I have a very strong, I have a thick skin. Like, you cannot be a biologist if you cannot be wrong 95% of the time. Like, nature is too surprising for us to get it right every time. And that's, to me, I kind of have developed a delight in being wrong about things like that. So, I mean, otherwise, what are you going to do, right? Someone at the beginning of the pandemic said, oh, how long is it going to take to have a vaccine? I said 4 years, because at the time, that was the fastest a vaccine had ever been developed. Less than a year later, there was a needle in my father's arm as an at-risk person. That's amazing. I was delighted to be wrong about that. Absolutely delighted. That's the right direction to be wrong in. So when we're teaching not just our children about how to try things out and to experiment and to innovate, but in our businesses and our organizations, working within our teams, not only giving folks the power and the imperative to experiment on their own, but then holding the space to really figure out what it means if it didn't go the way you thought it meant, that's really important. And I see a lot of corporates in particular falling down on that, like not holding the space to really think about what was going on, because it's like, do it faster, do the cycle again, faster, more cycles. It's like, well, hold on. Maybe we can save ourselves 10 cycles down the line if we take the time now to figure out what this cycle was really telling us. And in my experience as an academic science, that was both the joy and the frustration of academic science was the pace, right? Yeah, it's slower than working in industry, but you're expected to think deeply and you are empowered to hold that. So for that bio-inspiration, inward-looking piece, I would love for us to see the value in slowing down, to really digging deep into what something is trying to tell us, what the data are trying to tell us, and coming at it with that mindset. There's something here I can learn. It's my job to figure out what that is. I think that's just kind of one piece of it. The other interesting thing that I think about a lot is uncertainty. We're moving into a world that is, what is it, volatile, uncertain, complex, and I don't remember what the A is, ambiguous. What is the A in Zuka?
Yeah.
So in science, we are basically taught that we don't understand things and that tomorrow we're not going to understand it either. Hopefully tomorrow we're a little less ignorant than we are today. But this idea that, for me, I always think of our scientific results as not temporary, but like the best we've got right now. And I expect that someday soon, someone's going to come up with an idea that's going to force us to change what we already know. That is not the way we humans tend to look at our social and our societal constructs, right? We want the answer. And if something needs to be changed, the narrative is, oh, that's because it was wrong. Well, I mean, maybe, but the other option is we just actually know a little bit more now. So let's turn toward that area of light that we have now and see where the next area of light is going to be. Again, holding lightly this idea that we know the answer or that science should know the answer. Science isn't a body of knowledge. It's a process. It's a process for making tomorrow a little less ignorant than today was. And I get really excited when I see folks who are not scientists bringing that mindset to everything that they're doing. A learner's mindset, a curiosity mindset, someone who is excited about figuring out what they've got wrong. That's the kind of person I want to spend time with. And I think that's the mindset that's going to help us navigate the coming years, which I suspect are going to be extremely challenging.
I couldn't agree more, and I want to stress this because it goes to something that over the last few years has worried me more and more, which is exactly because for most of us, the scientific mindset doesn't come natural. The idea that it's a learning process, that there is uncertainty, that we learn from the mistakes, and that nonetheless there is value in the scientific approach is not widely recognized. And therefore, what worries me is that in some circumstances, there has been, therefore, a reaction by scientists, which is a reaction that tends to underplay the uncertainty and to tell the public, we do know, we have the answers, there's no room for debate anymore. And then, of course, what happens is that since this is by definition not true, then something comes up that contradicts the supposed certainty and undermines confidence in science altogether. And what you're pointing out is that impressing upon everyone, all of us, that uncertainty and discovery are part of the scientific process would be tremendously powerful. Now, this is a very powerful point, Tiffany. I feel like we could go on for a few more hours, but we have to be respectful of our audience, and so our audience will have to wait for more of your insights in a future episode. But before we wrap it up, anything that we've left out and you would really want the audience to take away from our conversation?
I believe that we have agency in building the future together. The future is not something that happens to us. It's something that we make, and we make it together. And so I would encourage every person listening to this, think of something you can do today, no matter how small, that will make your future better. If you can change the world, awesome. I give you a gold star. If you can just change how your family does something together tonight, that gets a gold star too. This is something we can do together. We really can. It's a matter of grit and resilience and courage and optimism and stick-to-itiveness and to just keep trying. Go out there and plan an experiment and see what you can learn.
Amen to that. Dr. Tiffany Vora, thank you so much for being on our podcast. This was a conversation which was delightful and so full of insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite place for podcasts is. And you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you very much.